I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
A warm welcome for Hans Ulrich Obrist and Tom McCarthy. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Claire, and hi, Hans Ulrich. And this is this is quite a book. I mean, it's wonderful. And I was very honoured to be asked to write this small introduction, because, you know, I'd been thinking a lot about maps in relation to my own work and in relation to, you know, literature and art in general. And I'd kind of done some research into basic cartography 101. And the first thing you find out in any textbook about maps is very interesting. It's basically that they don't work. There's no such thing as a good map, for the simple geometric reason that the Earth is spherical but paper is flat, and it's physically impossible to convert a sphere onto a two-dimensional plane. So any map, unlike a globe, which is a kind of miniature, it's a model, a map is a projection. And I love this term. It has kind of psychoanalytic as well as formal and mechanical kind of connotations. And so the first decision any cartographer has to make is what type of projection to use. You can go for zenithal, stereographic, orthographic, sinusoidal, gnomonic, and 20 others, which all have their advantages, but their disadvantages as well. The main one being that at some point you're going to undergo infinite distortion. So on Mercator's map, which is the standard, you know, one that we had for centuries, you know, the kind of the equatorial regions pan out fine. I mean, okay, it makes Europe look very big and Africa look much smaller than it is. But generally, things look kind of a bit right until you get to the poles, and then they undergo infinite distortion, and Greenland becomes bigger than all of Africa. You can flip that by going for a polar gnomonic or a reverse Mercator, but then the equator undergoes infinite distortion. So basically, the map, the cartographer's quandary, is the same as the draftsman's quandary. It's the problem of perspective. So it seems that you soon find out that there's an intimate relationship between maps and art, Western traditional pictorial art, which continues well into the 21st and 20th century through conceptual art, and so on. So my first question to you, I guess, is what made you, as an art guy, a curator who's collaborated with pretty much all of the kind of prominent artists of our era, you know, what sparked your interest in maps in the first place?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. First of all, as Tom said, it's incredibly exciting to be here tonight. And thank you all for being here. And of course, many, many thanks to also Thames and Hudson, because this has been actually a very, very long durational project. One can say it's almost 5 years in the making. And I think that idea of having time or liberating time to do such books is a very wonderful thing, you know, if a publisher allows that to happen. And of course, Andrew Brown is here tonight, and without Andrew, this book would never have happened, because not only has he accompanied it, you know, editorially, but also been very, very instrumental to then actually turn this sprawling archive of maps into a structured book. Now, the thing is, how it started, I would say, it probably started when I was 17 years old. I visited the artist Alighiero Boetti. It was a few weeks after I had met Gerhard Richter, which was my first. I mean, basically, officially, Weiss were my first life-changing experience. And then Gerhard Richter, you know, a few weeks later, and officially Weiss said I should go and see this guy Alighiero Boetti in Rome. And
he's very famous for his huge maps.
Embroidered, right? Maps of the world. And obviously, you know, he would make these maps and then he would sort of had them embroidered in Afghanistan. He also owned a hotel, a conceptual hotel called One Hotel in Afghanistan. And he would have, you know, communities in Afghanistan embroider his map. But by the time the slow process of the embroidery had happened, the world order had changed and he needed to do the next one. And then, you know, the war broke out in Afghanistan, and he then continued to do them in Pakistan. So we looked at these amazing maps of Alighiero Boetti, and I had a conversation with him, which is actually very much reflecting, Tom, what you wrote in the preface, because we talked about Dürer, you know, we talked about Leonardo, we talked about that sort of whole connection of actually it being connected deeply to the draftsman's problem, the you know, the notion of the map. We talked about Holbein, all these names you mentioned, you know, came up, you know, by Boetti. But we also talked about one less known person who then became sort of my most important guide, one can say, in theory, who is Edouard Glissant. And Edouard Glissant is somebody Boetti always felt was very fundamental and, you know, encouraged me to read. And a few years later, I then met Glissant. He is a poet. It's very sad that he isn't translated more in, you know, into English. There are dozens of his books in French. He's from Martinique. Died about two, three years ago, and had for many, many decades written about this idea of mapping, actually about an archipelago rather than it being continental. He sort of says basically, and that's something, you know, Boetti felt was important, that if we think about the 21st century, the 20th century is maybe more about continental maps, mapping continents, whilst actually the 21st century will be more about archipelago. The archipelago is a passage and not a wall. The archipelago is welcoming and sheltering. It's not imposing. And that has obviously to do, you know, with the origin of Glissant, Martinique, you know, Cuba, Guadeloupe, Haiti. That is all part of that wonderful archipelago. But the archipelago map is also, and it's kind of interesting because in an almost telepathic way, both Tom and I, we share this interest in archipelago map. And I'll ask Tom in a minute a question about his archipelago, the cover of his new book. But, you know, Glissant sent me these fax, which we then, you know, used, which is actually a drawing. You'll find a different version of it also in the book, about this idea of the archipelago, you know, being a passage. And so that, I would say, were the triggers. The triggers for the interest were Boetti, there was Glissant. And then obviously, in some kind of way, I started to more sort of proactively 5-6 years ago encourage artists to contribute, you know, maps for an eventual book, which was then still virtual.
Most of these maps in this book came at your kind of prompting, right? They did them for you.
Yeah, they always do, and it's kind of like part of my, one could call them virtual exhibitions, because in some way I've always, you know, besides the exhibitions I would organize physically in museums, I would always have these exhibitions which are virtual exhibitions. And I mean, Do It was the beginning of that, where we ask hundreds of artists to write a recipe, to write an instruction, and then the book can be realized. I mean, the show can be realized or not, and that project still goes on now after 20 years. Then we had a similar thing with formulas. I was once in a cafe in Basel with Albert Hofmann, the man who invented LSD, and he on a napkin drew this very beautiful formula for LSD, and then I kind of thought, this is incredible, you know, and I showed it to many artists, and many artists then were prompted by that to do their own formula, and that gave actually, you know, it was the beginning of the previous
for now,
book. Yeah, Formulas for Now, which was also done with Thames and Hudson, and Rosemary Tockel then encouraged me, you know, to make it into a book, and then we spoke, you know, to the publisher. So the idea to always have, you know, and at the moment, after the maps, it's handwriting. It's the sort of thing that I observed, that handwriting disappears. Umberto Eco wrote a text in The Guardian about that, and I'm extremely worried about the fact that we no longer, you know, have this culture of letters, that letter writing sort of disappears and that handwriting disappears. And so I was thinking, how could we actually go beyond Umberto Eco's mere complaint and be positive and bring it back into the internet? So I started this campaign on Twitter and Instagram so that every day, and hopefully later tonight, we're going to post a handwriting by Tom, that every day, you know, I would post a handwritten sentence by an artist or an architect to basically celebrate the fact that, you know, nobody in this room has the same handwriting than the other. It is about the diversity of all these different handwritings. And that, of course, in a few years, will then again, you know, produce a book. So I always have these long-term, you know, virtual exhibitions, which usually lead to books. But then at a certain moment, they led to marathons also. And that was in 2005 in Stuttgart, because I was asked by a theater to do a theater performance. And I said, you know, they had contacted the wrong person because I'm not the theater director. And, you know, I just cannot do it. But then they said, is there not something you could put, you know, on stage? And then I thought, because I do these long, long conversations and parallel to the curating, I thought it would be interesting to do a nonstop conversation. And we did a nonstop Stuttgart conversation for 24 hours. And it was quite tough to be alone on stage. And then everybody had a great time and went for dinner, but I was still on stage. And I kind of thought, and that's why then in 2006, when I started as co-director at the Serpentine Gallery and the collaboration with Julia Payton-John started, we found this different format for the marathon because Julia invented the pavilions in 2000 and basically I had a year before came up with this marathon idea. So I started to do the marathons, you know, in the pavilion and it sort of proved to be more fun if two people are on stage because then if one has a low after 18 hours, the other one can take over. So we did it with Rem Koolhaas and it was this 24-hour marathon as a portrait of city. And ever since, you know, these projects of these sprawling, you know, archive projects not only lead to books, but they also lead to these live events. There's a desire for this live moment. They're kind of hybrids between performance, maybe festivals, one can say, and also talks.
Salons. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's obviously fantastic, and we're extremely honored that Richard Sennett, one of the great pioneers of the marathons, who has been so instrumental in the marathons, is here, you know, with us tonight. And that then, you know, led to the MAP marathon. So at a certain moment, the idea was there to do a book, but then the MAP marathon really started to intensify the work on it, and and that's still early stages because then it somehow became also important to bring in the digital, and that was a whole other chapter.
Yeah, it's interesting this slip from Boetti to Glisson, you know, from the visual artist to the writer, and that you mentioned so many writers because it seems to me that, I mean, maps and literature are as intimately linked as maps and visual art. I mean, the Divine Comedy is kind of a mapping exercise. I mean, and you can trace that all the way through to something like, I don't know, Pynchon's Mason and Dixon or whatever. I mean, it's always been with Lewis Carroll, this huge, you know, looming presence in the middle. Or, you know, Ulysses is kind of a mapping exercise of Dublin and so on. And I don't know. I mean, I have a kind of personal relation to this. Relation, because, you know, I grew up in Greenwich, which is the centre of the world, and I mean literally, you know, it is the prime meridian, and I used to skateboard across this line every day when I was a kid, and also this is where Conrad sets the secret agent, because there was a real attempt to blow up the observatory that failed just inches or feet away from that line, and you realise that actually space is completely arbitrary. The meridian could be anywhere. In fact, it used to be in Paris, and then London kind of politicked it off them at some conference, and that they kind of strong-armed everyone to vote for London. And there's, I mean, it's literally a fiction. I mean, there is a line, an inscription, a piece of writing in the earth. And I realized that, you know, geography means like writing the earth, inscribing the earth. So, I mean, this kind of relation between literature and maps, and it was very interesting for me to read your afterword, where you mentioned the importance of Mark Lombardi to this whole project. Mark Lombardi did these amazing kind of paranoid but true kind of mappings of power and influence and of the kind of relation between corporate power and governmental power and the CIA and so on, and then died in mysterious circumstances to kind of top it all. But I didn't realise until I'd read your piece that he referred to these, you know, visual art pieces as narratives. He says this is a narrative. Which is kind of interesting. I mean, that a map or a piece of visual art should be thought of as primarily a narrative. I mean, do you see all these as narratives in some way?
No, it's fascinating, the link to literature, because I think, I mean, Alain Robbe-Grillet, who is an author we both admire, whenever I, you know, met with him, talked about maps, and obviously if you look at, you know, Jalousie, for example.
Oh, it has a map on the first page.
Has a map on, yeah, the first page. But that came later, because I became friends with Robbe-Grillet in the late 90s. But I think the beginning, really, with literature maps for me is kind of Robert Walser, because I founded this museum in 92 as a museum on the move. So it's a portable museum. And I mean, I could say that that map book is kind of a portable exhibition, because obviously all the maps being made for the book, you know, one can say, you know, it doesn't exist outside the book form. So the book is kind of the exhibition. So we did this sort of portable, movable museum for Robert Walser, for his walking eye. And I mean, some kind of way, Walser's, I was very fascinated as a teenager, of course, by Walser's walks, but also by the way he, in his fictitious exile to Paris, because he obviously was in Berlin in his real exile, then he was in Switzerland in his interior or inner exile, is probably the word in English. But then he had this, you know, fictitious Parisian exile, which never had happened. And in some kind of way, he wrote these Parisian papers, quoting here, "To me, the Parisian papers are a substitute for the theater. Also, not even the finest restaurants will I honor with my feet. So subtle have I become. Gulps of beer no longer pass my lips. My ear approves only the most melodiousness of the French language. Once I adored a lady, a true lady, today I find her most clumsy since Le Figaro has spoiled me. Did Le Matin not drive me half mad while my colleagues write themselves sick in this modern time of crisis? I grow exuberant through my papers, a trip which I intended to take to Paris I consider completed. I became acquainted with France's capital by way of reading." So this whole idea that he kind of mapped Paris without actually ever having been there.
It's very like Des Esseintes in Huysmans, who kind of maps the world by sitting in his bath and smelling perfumes from Italy. He'd rather smell the perfume. It's better than going to Italy. That doesn't smell Italian enough, you know. So, but it was also, I mean, you mentioned Walser. I was very interested to learn that that Walser was quite a big influence on the Situationists as well. And I mean, you were born a year before me, virtually to the day. I mean, you were born in May 68. And I think for both of us, this is the kind of year zero, right? The kind of, you know, this mythical time when Situationism kind of, you know, reached its apotheosis in Paris. And of course, these guys are absolutely obsessed with maps and strategies of kind of alternative cartography and dérive and détournement and making fake maps and so on and so on. And you actually, you interviewed, I can never pronounce his name, Raoul Varaghem. And he talked about Walser, and I mean, tell us a bit about his whole how that whole way of thinking about space and cartography influenced your thinking with this book.
Yeah, that whole idea that sort of linked to Situationism was sort of important because of the whole idea of the dérive. And now, obviously, Guy Debord is dead, so it's too late to interview him. But Raoul Varaghem is still alive, and obviously a wonderful author. But he never appears in public. He doesn't want, you know, to appear in photographs. But he agreed to be interviewed by letter. So we did this long interview, which became a little book as a correspondence. And then once the book was out, I wrote to him and I said, you know, it would be wonderful that we could meet, and you know, I could give him the book. So he gave me an appointment in Brussels, you know, and we met over a beer, and he basically said, you know, obviously, no photographs being taken of the meeting because he wants to stay anonymous. And so, you know, and he lives in the countryside as a recluse. And in that conversation, we had in Brussels, he actually talked about Robert Walser. And it's fascinating that that connection between Robert Walser and Situationism was, for me, also new. It came out of that conversation. He said, it's a quote, "I hold Robert Walser in high regard, as many do. His lucidity and sense of dérive enchanted Kafka. My psychogeographic dérives with Guy Debord in Paris, Barcelona, Brussels, Basel, and Antwerp were exceptional moments combining theoretical speculation, sentient intelligence, the critical analysis of beings and places, and a pleasure of cheerful drinking. Our home ports were pleasant bistros," that's actually where I met him, in a bistro, "with a warm atmosphere, havens where one was oneself because one felt in the air something of the authentic life, however fragile and short-lived. It was an identical mood that guided our wanderings through the streets, the lanes and the alleys, through the meanderings of a pleasure that our every step helped us gauge in terms of what it might take to expand and refine. It just a little further. So that sort of whole idea that Walser was a trigger for the situation is the reef seemed kind of very fascinating. But Tom, I wanted to ask you a question, because just looking at your, you know, new book cover, that's an archipelago map. And, you know, we talk here about Robert Walser's map. We talk about Ulysses. We talk about Pynchon. And we talk, of course, about Vanagon and Guy Debord. But it would be fantastic to hear from you what's the kind of role of map. Because beyond the fact that it's on the cover of your book, it plays a very big role.
Yeah, well, I don't know. The new book's called Satin Island, and it's about the hero's an anthropologist, but a corporate anthropologist. I mean, this kind of ties in with situationism. I think it's quite interesting the way that so much of that logic and practice and strategies, which belonged then to the far left, have just been recuperated, as Debord would say, into basic, you know, the strategy of the corporate creative industries. I mean, as your friend Rem Coolhouse points out, this idea, Dali's idea of critical paranoia, is now just a corporate brainstorming session. I mean, so there's this kind of interesting drift into mainstream practice. And I guess, I don't know, it's hard to talk about the book. I mean, I literally just finished it. It won't be out for another 6 months. But the American designer has just made this beautiful cover that's kind of referencing Tres Tropiques and the idea of archipelagos that are also maybe just ink splats and the idea of, you know, how do you constellate points? How do you map reality? I mean, this is why I think the situationists are so important, because their mapping wasn't a kind of passive mapping. It was an active production and a very political production of not just reality, but a disruptive projection of other realities, you know, this is important, right? This is an important kind of history to plug into. I think your book's plugging into this quite a lot. I mean, lots of the maps in it are not real maps in any describable way, and yet they seem to have a kind of I don't want to use the word truth, but a kind of force, compellingness. To them. But then at the same time, I mean, it's interesting that you've got quite a lot of maps by people who aren't artists or writers. I mean, they're scientists. I mean, you've got Tim Berners-Lee, who you just told me doesn't do email, which is amazing. But that's kind of, so there are maps showing the spread of disease or species extinction or house prices in London or the effects of a tsunami. I mean, why was... I mean, I know you say in your afterword, and you credit Georgi Kepes for this, you say this book is an attempt to go beyond the fear of pooling knowledge. I mean, do you see the scientist maps and the artist maps as kind of essentially the same, or do you think there's like a categorical difference in what they're doing and the way a map functions for these, in a kind of C.P. Snow two cultures kind of way?
It got definitely to do with the C.P. Snow idea. I mean, it's very inspired by John Brockman's website, Edge, one of my favorite, places to read things online on edge.org, where many of the great scientists of the world, are being interviewed, are publishing texts. But at the end of the year, John Brockman always, in homage to James Lee Byers, asks a great question, and then it's like a World Question Center every year, and that produces... I mean, that's kind of maybe actually important, because in some kind of way, that's definitely an inspiration for this type of book. Is, Brockman asks a question every year, and then the entire science world kind of reacts to it, and that produces a book. And that's a little bit in a slightly different way, but what, I'm doing with the art world, with these projects, which sort of grow over time. But then at a certain moment, in very close dialogue with Brockman, I felt it would be really interesting to get, particularly with a topic like maps, scientists involved. And so we teamed up with John Brockman, and that was particularly at the moment of the marathon. He brought many scientists to give lectures, but then also actually put online through his whole Edge community an open call asking for maps from scientists. And there were many wonderful responses from geneticists, from all kinds of scientists, mathematicians, and of course, basically the inventor of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, came up with this amazing map, which he told me the other day, because I finally met him for the first time in person, and he told me that we should look at it with a magnifying glass. And if we look in the book with a magnifying glass, you'll make very astonishing discoveries, which you actually don't see, and the map becomes even more political, because it's obviously a map which very much, is critical, deeply critical of the commercialization of the World Wide Web as it happens now, which is against the idea of what he, as the founder of it, had imagined this to be. And a lot of that is actually almost encrypted in the map. So that can be fun to kind of look at Tim Berners-Lee map with a magnifying glass. But then, it was sort of with Edge that we did this, and so you can say it's almost, but we, and that was important when the editing happened with Andrew, that we didn't want to have a book within the book, just all the science maps, but we started to mix them up according to different categories. And so you will find in the book art maps and science maps, wildly mixed, which we thought is more exciting.
Yeah. I mean, one thing, I think you're more kind of connective, much more than me in this respect. I mean, I always balk when I hear the word neuroscience. I mean, I'm more than balk. I kind of get angry. I mean, at the transfer, this kind of transfer of neuroscience to the realm of culture, because I'm very wary. I think it's actually one of the great intellectual follies of our era, this idea that if we could do a brain scan of Joyce, we'd understand Ulysses, or Shakespeare, we'd understand Hamlet. I mean, it's politically conservative, and it's just plain wrong, because the whole point about art is that it takes place in the symbolic. I mean, it's about language and history and power and gender and all these things, a set of relations which are ongoing and exterior and contingent, and most importantly, contestable, right? That's why we have art in the first place. It's political. These things can be contested and have been ever since the Greeks. And I wonder if there's a... I mean, this is not at all a critique of, because lots of the science maps in this book are really fantastic. But I wonder if there's a kind of category difference between people that are using maps to reveal a fixed truth on the one hand, and on the other, people that are using maps to produce a kind of radical ambiguity and put it in the world in the form of a map, which is a narrative, which is a, et cetera. I mean, do you think that kind of distinction holds between basically positivism and art?
I mean, it goes back to Boethi, because it goes back to the, and to what you said initially, this kind of impossibility of a map, that they never work. And I think, in some kind of way, Boethi had another endeavor, which I thought is probably his absolute, mapping endeavor, which is that he wanted to map the 1,000 longest rivers in the world. Now, obviously, we can neither, map rivers, nor can we measure them, because whenever we measure them because of the meandric, river flow, lots of different results come out. So if you look basically in different sources, there is not one reliable source for the length of a river. So he worked for years and years. I mean, that's pre-internet, so they had to consult all these archives. On all these, river length, and he did this amazing book called 1,000 Longest Rivers.
Berners-Lee.
Yeah, here is the Tim Berners-Lee's map, and somewhere there is this little tower, and that's where you have to put the magnifying glass. And so then, Boethi made this book. It's 1,000 pages, and on each page you've got what he considered to be the most reliable source of the length of the river, and then all the basically contradictory sources. So it's very much a book of, order and disorder, and it's sort of is a mise en abyme, really, of any kind of mapping, mapping endeavor. But I think, what is interesting about the art science thing, I suppose, is that, these projects are very much sort of inspired always by this idea of Diaghilev, and he and Cocteau had this exchange about the etonema. It is about people are invited to come up with something surprising. So it is actually very interesting that very often scientists contribute extremely unexpected maps, which go also outside. And all of that. And so in some kind of way, that's what's interesting about Andrew's idea to mix it, because sometimes it's actually very blurry what is an art map and what is a science map.
I mean, I think all of my favourite... I know you're not allowed to say this because you've got to be impartial, but I'm allowed to say it. And lots of my favourite ones in this book are always the ones that... My favourite section is the unmappable section, where you go straight for the blind spot, which is actually the most interesting part of any map, anyhow. So in a way, it's about knowledge production, not in the form of what we can then know, but in the form of what we can not know. New things that we cannot know, new blind spots, blank spots. And this seems also to be a very, a logic that comes from situationism, Guy Debord's idea, which is also very like the Wiener's idea with cybernetics, that knowledge gets interesting not at the center of its kind of playing field, but beyond the borders, where it stops working, where it kind of meets another whole form of discourse with another logic, and things start to unravel. And I mean, there's a brilliant... There's quite a few maps in this book, like Anri Sala kind of maps a non-existent person, and Pei White talks about how a void is a real space, and Philip Pareno's brilliant kind of map, which is actually an essay, which is... I don't know what it is, but he says, you know, the invisible is what has to remain invisible so that the visible can be visible. It's brilliant. You know, and then he also says something really interesting. You mentioned this idea of an event, the production of event. He says, Pareno, a map is where a frame is...
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Established that allows something to happen. That's brilliant. I mean, especially when you think of it in relation to his Zidane movie, which is about exactly that, the cartography of a football pitch and the production of an event, which is a football game, you know, and yet for most of the time nothing's happening because you're only watching Zidane. And it reminded me of, you know, Mallarmé's line about nothing will have taken place except the place and the amount of white space there is in his book. And then you have Dominic Gonzalez Foster's contribution to this book, which looks very much like Mallarmé's Throw of the Dice, of all its typographic exercises and blank spaces. But I mean, sorry, I'm going on and on, but the question is, I mean, you seem to be very drawn, for all the right reasons, to this kind of these voids, these chasms, right? These white on white moments.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a chapter. Then there are the very political maps. You have, you know, Claude Parence, the French urbanist who is now in Rem Koolhaas' Architecture Biennale in Venice. He very present. He develops a map about climate change, and that's, I mean, in some kind of way, that leads us almost to the next sort of big research we're doing, the next marathon we're doing at the Serpentine, which will be about extinction. Because actually, when we talked about, you know, mapping of climate change, Gustav Metzger got very upset, because he says basically, you know, nothing will ever change if we talk about climate change or if we talk about environment. We need to talk about extinction, because only if we really talk about extinction, you know, people will wake up. And so he encouraged us to do an extinction marathon, and obviously extinction in all kinds of forms. And, you know, A.S. Byatt pointed out the other day when we met her with Adam Thurwell that when is the last time we have all seen a centipede? And there was a very weird silence at the table. And, you know, we really hadn't seen a centipede in a long, long time. It's obviously during our childhood, it was a rather frequent appearance. And so extinction of all kinds of species, you know, the menace of the extinction of bees, et cetera, et cetera. And Gustav Metzger's kind of with us developing this this marathon. And you know, it has to do with this map here of Claude Parent. But I'm still with your previous thing about the unmappable. I'm also, for me, I mean, I don't have a favorite section in the book, and obviously I love all the maps in the book, but I mean, there is one map which is certainly the map which touched me most, and I still think about it very, very regularly, which is about a few days, really, maybe a week or so before she died, Nancy Spiro, the great American artist, did her last work. It's the last work she ever realized, which is basically about the non-mappability of death. We cannot map death. And I think that's one of the deepest and most incredible works of art.
It's a kind of a set of squiggles with heaven at the top and hell at the bottom, right?
So yeah,
and
a big, it's a trembling
void in between.
And it has again the void in between, yeah.
Should we open this conversation up? Maybe, I don't know how long. Oh, well, yeah. Should we? Would people like to? I mean, we can just carry on talking, but I mean, if no one wants to jump in right now, but maybe someone does.
I ask you about Google Maps. I loathe Google,
And the thing that's always struck me about the Google Maps is that they have no correspondence to the reality of what you experience when you walk or even when you drive. And without being paranoid about it, that this is intentional, I wonder if in a way the kind of mapping that they do, which is the shortest distance between two points, the most efficient distance between two points, as I say, without being paranoid about it, isn't actually a way of destroying the lived reality of what you experience in the city. It seems to me an absolutely nefarious way of thinking about mapping a city, that the way you want to go is the shortest way.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Tom, you should start because Google Maps pop up in your text.
They have loads of glitches. But yes, totally, it's evil. And it's a return to the rigidity of the Cartesian grid. It's a gridding of space. I mean, it's a reversal of the whole kind of impetus of dérive and twisting and détournement and, you know, opening up gaps of difference and so on and so on. And one thing I actually love about this book is the number of bad grids in it. I mean, earlier we saw Ernesto Neto, the picture of a net that had gone wrong. Several of the artists especially use grids. Fia Backstrom has all these dissolving grids, and Toyo Ito has a kind of cheese-like labyrinth of holes. So there's a lot of people that are systematically attacking that very Cartesian / Google kind of logic. And I think quite a lot of people have read Deleuze as well, I'm guessing, of your artists. There's a lot of Margarita Glitzberg has a rhizomatic navigational kind of app, you know, if you like. That's her contribution. And Kerif Wynne-Evans has torn up a face and made a Deleuzian kind of fold. And I think especially the artists are trying to introduce a lot of glitches into that orthogonal space of power, you know.
You know, in society, the return of this kind of orthogonal tyranny of this is one of the most terrible things that's happened to people's understanding of the city. And you know, artistically, you can see all the what shouldn't happen, but in terms of power relations, something like Google Map is a way of dominating people's experience. And it sells. It is hegemonic.
Yeah.
And the question is obviously in terms of resistance, you know, and I think that's actually something, Tom, I wanted to ask you in relation to situationism, because in the very first marathon in 2006, you know, Rem Koolhaas said, you know, the whole situationist vocabulary has also become very used, and it's kind of like
psychogeography just means like Sunday supplement journalism.
Exactly, so it's a cliche, or as Louis Bourgeois would have said, a plâtre de platitude, no?
Yeah.
And so in this sense, we need a new kind of, maybe neologisms or whatever that could be. And I was wondering, Tom, because when we met for the first time, you know, and you, it was just at the moment when you were both in the art, I mean, you're still in all these worlds, in these parallel realities. You're obviously still in the art world, but you now also have a major, you're a major force in the literature world. And that was just about to happen when we met, that you started to go into the literature world more. But at that time, you had also a lot of work with neo-situationism. You had the and have the Necronautical Society. You showed me lots of pamphlets in our very first meeting, pamphlets with maps. And I was kind of wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that and how, you know, that sort of over time changed,
yeah.
And where you see such a new language or new vocabulary could go, addressing, you know, Richard's essential concern,
yeah,
that we need a critique of that, and
yeah,
knowing at the same time, as Rem said in 2006, the situationism is no longer that critique.
Yeah, I've been reading Michel de Certeau recently. He's brilliant. He's fucking brilliant. I mean, and it totally addresses all that. He's a Jesuit priest, bizarrely. I mean, who'd have thought it? But his vision is kind of, it's very interesting. He sees exactly what you're saying. We're trapped within the orthogonal space of power. And he calls this a scriptural space. It's a set of inscriptions, a gridded inscription on space, and all our experience is kind of controlled and prescripted and so on. And then his kind of strategy of resistance is kind of, he talks about abjection in this kind of Julia Kristeva, Georges Bataille way, just abjection. You know, he talks about cries of pain, things that escape. You know, he talks about the linguistic equivalent of erections or of rips and wounds. And I mean, I guess that's kind of Christian in an interesting way. And then he talks about, after Beckett, he talks about the unnameable. And this is kind of, which would be the unmappable as well. But how he tries to reinsert that into the grid. And for him, this would not be outside of language or outside of writing, but it would be a kind of counter-scriptural writing, a breakout of unmappability, of glitch. And I think that's very kind of compelling. And I think it's a lot more sophisticated than lots of Du Bois thinking around, or a lot more applicable to now. But I'd like to know what you think. I mean, you're kind of an expert on this. More than me.
No, it would be great, Richard, to hear. No, the other thing I think that it's incredibly urgent that Edouard Glissant is translated. I mean, I think that is really seeing again also Tom, your cover of your book. You know, I think there is it's very strange because we mentioned Deleuze, and obviously Deleuze is very present in these maps. But I mean, if you think about what is a toolbox for the 21st century, what is a toolbox to resist the homogenizing forces of globalization, which is obviously what is at stake, I suppose, in what Richard describes in relation to the city. What is a toolbox to resist that? It seems to me Glissant is the key model.
I mean, his name is Glissé, right? Sliding.
Exactly. It's sliding perfect. It's perfect. It's sliding off the grid. And I read Edouard Glissant every day 50 minutes when I wake up in the morning. It's one of my many rituals. Because as Tarkovsky said, we need to reintroduce rituals in our ritual, you know, less kind of lives of the early 21st century. Tarkovsky always said, I mean, he was alive, of course, the later part of the 20th century, and he said, you know, rituals disappear. And so I always thought, like, and another ritual of mine is to buy a book, at least one book every day. So that's kind of an urgent ritual being in the bookstore. But it is this ritual of reading Edouard Glissant every morning. And I think Edouard Glissant, I mean, there is this very wonderful thing about mapping where he talks about the archipelago map as opposed to the, you know, the continental map, but he also talks about the map, the cartography of mondialité. And I think the cartography of mondialité is very much an answer to that sort of, you know, homogenizing mapping, which happens now again. Because he talks about this idea that we have in the current moment different possibility to negotiate in our mapping endeavors, as also in our all other endeavors in our life, I suppose, these forces of globalization, which are, I mean, it's not the first time that we live globalization. I mean, I suppose the Roman Empire was a moment of globalization, but it's certainly the current moment, also technologically driven, is the most extreme, if not most violent moment of globalization there has ever been. And as Glissant says in his texts on mondialité, this obviously leads to the homogenizing forces and tyranny which we can see now, on the one hand, by embracing these forces of globalization, yet at the same time, by rejecting them completely, it leads to all the neo-nationalisms we can, you know, observe in big parts of Europe now. And so Glissant basically proclaims this idea of the mondialité, which is a permanently different, it's basically an engaging in global dialogue, but it's permanently only by creating difference. So it's basically it's resisting the annihilating forces of the homogenized globalization, but not refusing that global dialogue, but entering it, which I think is really this incredibly interesting negotiation which can happen right now. And he did this in his poems, he did this in his urbanism.
What decade is he?
I met him in the 90s, and then he was sort of 60. So he died in his late 70s, early 80s. So he would have lived from 29 to...
So he's writing this in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. He would have lived... And he would have worked in the 50s, 60s, 70s. I mean, he was in the colonial liberation, he was a friend of Fanon. He was very much part of the, in the 50s, you know, of that struggle. And he then became also a very, very eminent poet, wrote amazing books on William Faulkner. I mean, it's a whole oeuvre to discover, and it's just a complete scandal that it's not translated. It's as important as Deleuze, but it's not translated.
It's so you talk about Bruno Latour in a very similar way in your afterword, and you point out that he said, I mean, quite recently, when he writes about the digital and you know, neoliberalism and so on, that the challenge for the whole, you know, the crux of subjectivity and of politics and of aesthetics and everything is navigation. That's what it comes down to. It's just all about navigation, which is kind of what Lewis Carroll said as well, thinking of maps in The Hunting of the Snark. But navigation was always a difficult art. But it's just occurred to me that this book is actually, it's almost like your autobiography. I mean, everything you do is about mapping connections. And then it's not just the map, it's the app too. I mean, for several decades now, you've been coming up with strategies, Formulas for Now, as your last book was called, which is a kind of reaction to this. You make the map, then you create the app. Is that kind of good way? I mean, do you see what I'm saying? This book or this project goes to the core of kind of what you're about. No?
Yeah, I suppose that all of these...
And what you do as a curator and as a cultural agent, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, all of these projects are kind of, they're like, for me, they're like mobile exhibitions. They're kind of very inspired by, you know, this idea when Duchamp did his box and you could carry the exhibition everywhere. And I always loved this idea that it's, that they're kind of, you know, they're portable exhibitions. And then I was always wondering, obviously, because with the mapping book, it's very much, it takes into account the digital age. You know, however, it's an incredibly physical object. And then always was the question, you know, could one actually make such an exhibition, you know, digitally? And the first kind of time I do this now is with the handwriting project, because the handwriting project actually, which is again, I mean, it has to do with resistance. It has to do to resist the disappearance of, because I think the question is not only what, you know, all the possibilities we gain in the digital age, but the big thing is what we lose. And I mean, one of the things we might lose is memory, for example. I mean, the thing, amnesia might very well be at the center, you know, at the core of the digital age, which made us do at a certain time the Memory Marathon in close collaboration with Eric Hobsbawm. It was the last project Eric Hobsbawm worked on, and was actually his very last text, was this text, you know, he was writing for us on memory, on this necessity of the protest against forgetting, you know, in the digital age. And so in a similar way, the handwriting project, it's again to do with that resistance, but the handwriting project sort of goes the other way around. Or it's kind of a paradox, because it happens on Instagram and Twitter, because as I thought, it would be really important to introduce handwriting, you know, into these new sort of formats. And obviously these new formats are not made for handwriting. Twitter is not really, made for handwriting. You just, you know, type the number of characters, but, you know, we just post images of these handwritten sentences, you know, through Instagram and Twitter. And so it's a form of, you know, circulating it that way. But obviously it's just a detour, because at the end, I'm quite convinced that whole handwriting project will again produce a book. So what did Anthony Powell say? Books do furnish a room.
Books do furnish a room. We've got Margarita Glitzberg here, and then there's a man at the back.
Okay. Is that okay?
Yeah,
I just wanted to actually ask about, because maybe there is a kind of disappearance of the map and the difference between directions and maps, because actually... I mean, in a way, the direction is... directions was something that preceded the map, you know, go there, turn left, turn right, and there's no kind of authoritarian projection, like you say, that this fake projection. But actually what's happening now with SatNav is that, you know, in that same of the evil empire, we're being given directions, you know, and as all good ideas. So the Deleuzian structure of not kind of being a nomad, where you're just given direction, there's no long-term vision, there's just this short-term nomadic space, but actually it's completely directed. So, you know, like all good ideas, they're appropriated by corporate structures and basically turned into another sort of
control
device, which I think is really interesting. I mean, in the same way that Nick Land and Sadie Plant had this dream of the cyber kind of revolution, which turned into a marketplace, essentially. So I just wonder where we are with the disappearance of the map and the kind of capitalist colonialization of direction again.
No, this is yours. I mean... I mean, it's a general thing, isn't it? Yes, the man recuperates everything, as De Boer kept saying, but then he's taking in the glitches too, you know. So I mean, like in the postcard, Derrida says, you know, every advance in the postal system brings the police state a step closer, but it also gives the resistance better networks, you know, it creates new blind spots. I mean, it seems to, you know, there always seems to be new possibilities of a type of new types of resistance become possible. No, with the I'm not that pessimistic. Maybe I'm naive. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I mean, the question is also the sort of layering. You know, can there be a kind of can there be new hybrid maps in some kind of way? You know, and that's something you mentioned. Latour, and Latour talks about these layerings. You know, that there could actually be new forms of layering. That's maybe something to think about. But it's a big question.
In the 90s, when I lived in Berlin, there was, you know, there weren't mobile phones, obviously, and no one even had proper phones in the East. So people would just write in chalk. You know, when you were going to meet someone, and of course you were half an hour late, you just write on a wall, you know, we're in this pub or we're in this Hinterhof. And there was all over, and all over East Berlin, there'd be these little arrows saying, you know, Fred, this and here. Or
and it's like with the centipedes, you know, it's this idea that certain things disappear. I mean, the other day, I really had a shock the other day. It was completely under shock because we worked on this little book on my hotel exhibition, because I did this show in 93 talking about nomadism, you know, about artists living in hotels. And there was this hotel in Paris where Raymond Haynes, the great artist of the Derive, it's all about cartography and mapping. He, you know, he and Ville Glay walked through the street in Paris in the 56s and tore down posters and made these amazing, what they were called the désaffichistes, no? So Raymond Haynes lived in a hotel, and then I was kind of like thinking, wow, I mean, I was a student at that time. I thought this would be my dream, you know, to live in a hotel. So I went a few months to live in the same hotel until I couldn't afford it anymore. It was a very shabby, you know, hotel called the Carlton Palace, and the palace sign had fallen from the facade, and he stored his artworks in the corridor. I mean, it's unthinkable now, no? And so the artworks are in the corridor, and he was in, you know, in the hotel room, and I then decided to transform my hotel room into an exhibition space. So without really telling the hotel, I invited 70 artists to exhibit in my room, and the hotel just thought that it's weird, you know, this guy has a lot of visitors in his room. And then, like, after about 3 weeks, you know, there was this exhibition, and we announced it, and by the time the hotel realized what happened, it was too late to stop it, and there was, you know, queues of people coming and all of that. So anyway, to cut the long story short, we had this archive, and there wasn't at the time any possibility to do a book. So somebody in Germany did a hotel exhibition, and they wanted to publish my book 21 years after. So I went back to the archive box and, you know, contacted, together with Pierre Le Guillon, we contacted Richard Hollis, the legendary English graphic designer, who's always been a hero of mine. It was always my dream, you know, to do a book with him. So we brought him the book, the box, you know, with all the letters and stuff. And, you know, he designed this little, tiny little publication, you know, made out of all these archive things. And I had a complete shock, because in this box were hundreds and hundreds of incredibly beautiful little pieces of paper, which were basically messages taken by the hotel from people who called. So they would say, you know, at 7:53 p.m., there was a phone call from Frédéric Boulibouabre from the Ivory Coast, the late, you know, visionary African artist from the Ivory Coast, leaving you the following message. And then, you know, the hotel in handwriting. And so, but there were hundreds of those messages, you know, of artists calling from all over the world. And I, you know, the shock was that not only don't we have that today anymore, I had completely forgotten that we ever had it. It's something which, and whenever we were in hotel, we got these little pieces of paper, it's gone.
there's a man who's been waiting very patiently.
Hi. So as a neuroscientist, I sort of feel I should defend the the earlier allegation about sort of neuroscience goal to map the brain as a way to reveal, for example.
I don't think the fault lies with neuroscientists. I think it lies with artists who transfer the logic.
Yes, well, I think that's exactly right. So I think, you know, neuroscientists, you are absolutely right. The neuroscientists, you know, brain mapping is the hot topic in neuroscience at the moment. And everyone is investing, you know, Obama has given a presidential decree to investigate this. The EU is, I think, €1 billion up to investigate. And so the Human Connectome Project, there's lots of things going on about literally this, mapping the brain. But I think, you know, that isn't the same as saying that will mean that if we map Joyce's brain, then we'll understand Ulysses. I think there is an understanding that there is a kind of temporal component here, and that all the neuroscientists can do is map it out. And I think memory is a really good example of that. That you know, a memory is only a memory when you remember it. You know, there is a kind of temporal component there, and just the kind of layout itself isn't really going to tell you very much. But it will tell you more than we know now. So I kind of feel there is use in it, but it probably also highlights the limitations of mapping as a sort of scientific endeavor.
And also, I mean, one of the things to why I believe that the science part was very important to answer, you know, Tom, your point from before, is that, I mean, I really do believe that this disconnection between, you know, art and science is a great loss. And you know, we should never forget that Marcel Duchamp got his main inspiration from Poincaré, and that there can be these, you know, cross-fertilizing inspirations. And I do believe that, you know, hopefully with this book, because this book travels, you know, through the disciplines, that there are dozens of different practitioners are involved, many different scientists, artists, architects, poets, you know, novelists. And through that, you know, it hopefully will travel through all the fields and through all the disciplines. And, you know, I do believe that some of these science maps might be great inspiration for artists in a similar way Poincaré triggered something, you know, in Duchamp, as hopefully many of these artist maps might, you know, inspire scientists. So it is about this bridge somehow, or yeah. going beyond that fear of yeah. of pooling knowledge. And, you know, James Lee Byars, it goes back to James Lee Byars. I mean, James Lee Byars did his World Question Center, and he thought, you know, we need to talk to many different disciplines to get all the right questions. So he asked Sean Brockman to set up, you know, to get him all these different scientists. And he even at the end got the Dalai Lama, and, you know, he got Freeman Dyson, you know, to ask him a question. It's an incredible video. Should you ever, you know, see James Lee Byars from the 70s? And you have just all the great thinkers, philosophers at that time asking the question they were most, you know, and so the artist James Lee Byars did an artwork with it. What he didn't tell is that each time somebody asked the question, he hang up on them. So it was like a quiet, it was quite brutal.
You mentioned Latour, and geographers who are using the tradition of science technology studies like Nigel Thrift and Doreen Massey talk about scale as a practice, scaling as a practice, something that happens through activities. You also mentioned Certeau. So I was just wondering whether one way of thinking about these artworks is to think that what these artists are doing is materializing a world and a passage through it. It's not simply for me that they are creating representations. Obviously, you're saying that in different ways, but it's also that they're sort of making manifest or making some kind of ontology available to the viewer or the participant, and indeed to themselves, and then also a passage through it.
Yeah, I mean, Latour, because it's interesting that you would ask about Latour, because we didn't really go into that before when Tom mentioned it. I think in a way, I mean, Latour, I need to find this quote here. He sort of has actually written a lot, as Tom said, about navigational and cartographic strategies. And there is a text which addresses somehow, you know, your question called Entering a Risky Territory, Space in the Age of Digital Navigation. And he wrote this with another scholar, Valerie November, and another one called Eduardo Camacho Hübner. And that text investigates the relationship between the base map and the overlaying of secondary levels of contingent factors over the space, as well as the distinction made between physical and human geographies. So we can say that the advent of digital technologies has actually revealed that all these layers belong equally to the idea of the territory, and that the implication of these are wide, obviously, in both, you know, in terms of cartography. So that's what I meant before with these new, you know, new kinds of hybrid. And Latour is also an interesting example of what can happen, you know, when we make this bridge, you know, between the disciplines, because he obviously, you know, as a historian, you know, of science, has more than anyone else, you know, bridged, you know, philosophy with literature with science over the last years. And at a certain moment, we encouraged him to come into the world of exhibitions. And so in 99, we got him with Papa van der Linde into a laboratorium, and he thought it was very, very exciting that actually he would suddenly curate. So he curated a series of tabletop experiments where, you know, the scientists would do experiments in public. And when you transport an experiment from the public sphere, you know, from the laboratory into the public sphere, it can actually eventually fail. So it was that kind of experiment. And so he got so excited by this that he then decided to devote actually several years of his life and his work to the medium of the exhibition. He curated these remarkable exhibitions at the ZKM, in a similar way as Lyotard did, you know, in earlier times with Les Immatériaux. And we should not forget, I mean, that's another thing. I mean, I'm jumping now back to the previous question about science. I have obviously in my mind is that, you know, I do believe that making this bridge, you know, we can also kind of all of a sudden create unexpected new curatorship forms. Yeah, I think it's interesting, very interesting, if all of a sudden somebody from a totally other field like science or literature, you know, enters that world of, you know, medium of the exhibition. So by involving scientists in that kind of way, you know, in the show, things can happen, like that thing with Latour, which we triggered, then it happened with a small thing in laboratorium, and all of a sudden there were these shows.
I love this idea of the artwork and taking the form of an experiment. Or you think of Joseph Beuys with his performances that were kind of scientific lectures about, you know, with diagrams mm-hmm. that he just kind of made up, basically. You know, I mean, it's
or Panamarenko,
exactly, yeah. So, or John Latham, or Gustav Metzger. Thanks, sir. It's always great to be in this place. It's the best bookshop in London. That's great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much for your questions. Thank you, Richard. And most of all, thank you, Hans-Ulrich Obrist and Tom McCarthy.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.